Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to the Happiness Is podcast with me, your host, Bruce Aitchison from Happiness Is Egg-Shaped. And as is normal at the start of these things, I've got a big silly smile on my face because I am very excited. I've not been here for a while, so I might be a little bit rusty, so bear with me, but I've got an absolute hero on with me. And we are Friday night, it's 7 o'clock, and we'll tell you why that is significant when we get chatting. But if you're going to go, you might as well go big. You might as well go right to the very beginning. I am so excited. I first met this person about a year ago now, and I had the pleasure of a chat and then a bit of a live interview. And since then, I'd like to think we've become buddies, and I've watched a bit of a journey, and we're almost at the ticker tape finish, and I'm really excited to see how it goes. So let's not waste any more time, because it's not me you're here to listen to. It is the one and the only Sandra Colamartino. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce. Lovely to meet you again on podcast. Really excited to be here.
I'm so excited. Now, when we first met, I have to admit I was a little bit, oh, how's this going to go? And it was an absolute joy. And it's been so cool to speak to you over the last year, because things have really moved hugely. Now, I'm going to get you to rewind the tape right the way back to the beginning. You were Scotland's first captain, which is a big deal. But I want to know, how did you get to that point? Where did rugby come into your life?
Rewinding even further back, my father used to support Stirling County, and I was a schoolgirl in that area. And so we used to go down, and my dad played rugby on the wing, telling me he was brilliant, of course. And he was, he took me to watch the rugby, and I used to love watching it. And it was a real quality time with just me and my dad. And of course, I couldn't play because I was a girl. It was that straightforward, a long time ago now. So I used to go and watch the boys playing mini rugby and be in the stands watching the guys play. And there was just no girls playing at that moment. So my dad used to throw the ball backwards and forwards to me on the sidelines, like probably about 10 or so. And so I perfected my spin pass on the sidelines. That was really the start of my kind of love of rugby, really watching it at Stirling County, and also watching it on TV, the Six Nations. Like we were all, I think lots of people start watching rugby, watching Six Nations.
So did you realize it wasn't a thing? Did you go and wish you were playing, or did you just accept that girls don't get to play rugby?
Looking back, I don't remember pushing that hard. So clearly, maybe because I think there was a lot of girls maybe that, you know, around Scotland and beyond were just allowed to join in because they maybe were asking a bit harder that question. Honestly, my memory is just complete acceptance that that was not something I could do. My dad was like, that's a shame. You're a girl, because if you'd been a lad, I think you'd have been good at this. You could have joined in. So I think there was just a feeling that that was just not what you did. It was a shame, but never mind. And that was really where, for me, I accepted that as that was just a shame, but that was not for me. I was a girl. And that's my memory of it, not being like an angry girl, just that was a shame. That was something I could not do.
And what did you do if you couldn't play rugby? What was your interests?
I mean, at school I did hockey, you know. I remember playing hockey. I remember doing a little bit of running. I then actually took up karate about when I was about 12. So I became quite good at the moves. Quick, maybe that was quite good for, I don't know why, if that's useful or not, but it might have helped a little bit. But generally, I didn't really do much more than that at school. And then I went to art college. And art colleges, nobody is sporty in art college. We're way too cool. Smoking cigarettes, Marlboros, you know, just hanging out, dyeing our hair, you know. So we were not, I went down a route at 17 where I met a bunch of people that were non-sporty, sort of by definition of being, you know, more theatrical, more arty. So that meant that for about 3 or 4 years, I kind of just forgot about sport whilst I kind of hung out dyeing my hair and wearing Doc Martens. So that was in Dundee, you know. And then, I mean, timing wise, I graduated in 1990, and I always followed the men's rugby. So of course, 90, every rugby player knows was the Grand Slam. David Soule, Gavin Hastings, Doddy Weir. I mean, that was just, you know, Scotland men were absolutely peaking. And I was, I think, 18, and I was absolutely, or 19, I was absolutely hooked on that. I'd been to Murrayfield with my dad. And then I moved back to Edinburgh. And of course, everyone was mad about rugby. Scotland was in an absolute peak. So can you imagine, like, I saw this little advert in the evening news that was put out by Sue Brody, that was in 1990. And this is the start of my rugby journey, where I saw the advert. In fact, well, somebody saw it for me and told me about it. And that was the start of when I went along, met Sue Brody for the first time. And she had put this advert out saying, women's rugby, beginners welcome. And it was the first ever club side in Scotland. So up until then, it had only been university sides. And of course, that's where I'd missed out on that, because I was at an art college and there was no rugby anywhere to be seen up to now.
So when you arrive at that first session, mm-hmm. like, did you have boots? Did you, like, oh. I'm trying to picture this art college grad.
Let me help you, because honestly, it was horrific, because I had no sports kit, and I actually had, you know, those baseball boots that are like the stars, long Converse.
Yeah.
I had black Converse baseball boots on, and that was my trainers. And I just kind of thought, I'll go up to these guys trying to look like I know what I'm doing. And there was it was a Liberton Rugby Club, and there was this bank of about maybe 5 meters down to the pitch. And I just thought, I'll just kind of walk down casually. And I went absolutely flying, because they didn't have any grips. They've got not a single grip. I absolutely fell on my arse in front of these women that I'd never met. And that was probably one of the most embarrassing moments. It still makes me cringe because I'd never met them, and there I was trying to just kind of act casual that this was not a big deal. But for me, it was so exciting to be thinking this was a real thing. And Sue was there when there was maybe about half a dozen people. Lee Coburn was there, Julie Munro, you know, people that ended up playing for many years
being
for Scotland.
Legends, yeah.
It was an incredible little gathering looking back now, because some of that very early members of that team were, like me, had seen the advert and felt, you know, people had told them they should be getting along. Lee Coburn, actually a really good example, someone who's over 6 foot, incredibly athletic, ex-swimmer. Hard as nails. So from the very beginning, there was people there that were, you know, there was, as they say, it was the start of a team. You know, it was the start of something very special from 1990 onwards.
So we know about your firsts. Most people know about your firsts, but I don't think any of us realised you were at the first session as well. I love that you fell on your backside and then you become the captain.
I don't think that was not the first session. It was obviously my first session, but club, I mean, I think Liberton would maybe have been Sue, you know, I maybe joined them after, maybe, I don't know, it could have been 6 months or 3 months. It was certainly at the beginning of the time where Sue was really, you know, her advert did not get hundreds of replies. It got, yeah. You know, there was a struggle to try and get 15 players. And so when I remember going down, there was about eight or nine people. And I think we exchanged phone numbers. And then every single week, Sue kept phoning, "I hope you're coming. Are you coming? Are you coming? Because we need everyone." I mean, she was incredibly, you know, everyone that had showed an interest, she kind of made sure they stayed to come. But, you know, they kept coming because she was desperate to get 15 people to play a game. And she'd phoned up Royal Dick Vet College and had said, "Would you like to play a friendly with my team?" And of course, she needed 15. And so I think we had the 10 or 12. And then I remember very clearly that first match against Dick Vett. We didn't have any strips. So we borrowed, can you imagine this, Liberton. We asked them if we could borrow a set of strips. And they said, "Well, you can have these ones that the Colts have worn." And they were absolutely, they had been worn by the under 16s the day before. So absolutely minging, and they smell of Lynx aftershave. You know, they were like dirty, damp, stink of bad aftershave, cheap aftershave, and we put them on, and off we went and played Dick Vett. And incredibly, it was quite a close game. It was something like we lost about 10-0. We just couldn't believe that we actually had a team to get. I think we had 13 players. I don't think we made it to 15. And I think one of the players normally played hockey and literally was on the wing. You know, just literally hadn't come
just
to a single training session. She was just a friend of someone who I think came to watch and then said, "Look, you just put that shirt on. You're now a wing. You don't need to do anything. Just stand there." And then, of course, you know, that was the start of the team.
So I love the changing room, and whenever I speak to people, I always get to it at some point. But what was grab your stuff and disappear, or did you get use of the changing room?
I missed a little bit of that. I think were you just asking about the changing room? Just cut out a second.
Yeah, did you have access to the changing room? Were you given that privilege? So what was that like after the game? Go into a changing room having played your first game, I mean, there must have been high as kites.
I honestly actually have this memory of it was Liberton changing rooms, you know, it's quite a real old-fashioned clubhouse, and going into the changing rooms, we were so thrilled, like we're just like ecstatic. And I remember going into the shower and I washing my hair, and there was so much mud in it. It like dripped down my face, this mud from my hair, because it had obviously been squashed so much. It was quite a muddy day. And in fact, I may have to tell you my horrendous debut at scrum half because it's a kind of legendary story, this, but I went to put the ball in the scrum, as you do, and someone had said, like, you put the ball in and then you just have to get it back out again. So I had put the ball, I put the ball into the scrum, and then I literally went into the tunnel to get it. I didn't go round the back. I just sort of went in. I think I was just overexcited. I sort of went into the tunnel, and like the kind of ref kind of got me by the scruff of the neck, pulled me out and said, no, you've got to go round. You can't go in. So it wasn't that surprising. My hair was quite full of mud, because I think I just, the excitement of the whole thing, I just had forgotten that actually that was not quite what you meant.
I love that.
That was the level we were at.
I've never seen that. I've never seen a scrum half disappear up the tunnel before. That is gold.
I mean, I don't know what I was thinking, because I did know you didn't do that. I think I just was so excited to, and I was panicking, you know, and I thought, get the ball out. And I forgot to walk around the side, or go around the corner.
So Sue's obviously played a massive part in not just the life of Scottish women's rugby, but in your life.
Yeah. I mean, Sue was, looking back now, I mean, she's a lifelong friend. A lot of rugby people tend to be. I think this is part of the reason why I've wanted to share this story in 2000, you know, on the 30th anniversary. The reason why is I've just been thinking that I feel she's not really been recognised yet, because she's quite a quiet person, and she's the type of person that doesn't like a fuss made. But what she did for the women's game 30 years ago, now she is one of these people that says, I did that because I wanted to play, you know, because that was exactly why. She wanted a team of players so she could play. So she doesn't think of it as a sort of legacy. And that is often what, you know, I can understand that. But the reality of her doing what she did is allowed and facilitated like a whole generation of people to have and share like their whole rugby life story, you know, in Scotland. And if she hadn't done what she did, never mind the 94 World Cup, you know, it was before that. It was just, she got the ball rolling. And of course, it would have still happened. There's no question, because there was many other people that would have felt the same. But I think she got the ball rolling. You know, it's maybe helped the game be 5-10 years ahead. And that's reality.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%.
That's the bit that I want to share.
There's so many sliding door moments to this whole story, though, because she could have just wanted to play. Like you said, hundreds of other women wanted to play, but they didn't go about the action that she did to put an advert in the paper.
Exactly.
You know, if she'd just tried to do it by word of mouth, maybe only three people turned up and then they lost interest. But to put an ad, there's so many tiny little building blocks to this. And you're right, it would have happened. Of course it would have, but we might not have women's games on TV now. It might be 10 years in the future. It's an incredible thing that she did. And also, did she ever express a vision? Did she say, we're going to do this because then we're going to have a Scotland team and then we're going to do, or was she just hoping to play that game against Dick Vitt?
Honestly, I don't think there was any. And that's, I think, where she's, you know, possibly feels like a bit overwhelmed with the amount of interest, because she wasn't thinking like that. And we've talked about this. She was thinking about wanting to play, and she was no longer a member of the university, and so she had to form a club, and then we had to, you know, it led to like, well, we now have a team, we need to play in a league, and every step, every increment, and then obviously you've got this team of players like Lee Coburn and Donna Kennedy, suddenly you're like, well, we want to play, you know. So each layer has just like over a period of time sort of evolved. But she, you know, didn't go with a plan, you know, when she put that advert in the evening news. And looking back, especially, there's been a lot of reflection when we've been working on this project, you know, the 30th anniversary play. She the reflection has been that, you know, it wasn't planned, you know, and it just unfolded. And unfortunately for her, and fortunately for Scotland, Scottish women's rugby, she was there, and she was that little bit older and wiser, and she had the skill set to not be too phased about talking through, we need to form a union, we need to do this, and you know, the sort of thing that honestly I think I would have struggled with. She just was like, we just need to form a committee, we need to ask permission, you know. She just, because of her perhaps a bit more maturity than we were, young 20-year-olds, she was just towards, you know, she was late 20s, so she had more experience. She was a manager at a leisure centre, so, you know, she was used to dealing with, you know, I suppose the admin that would be involved with procedures, and so she wasn't too phased with the process that was required to sort of deliver, you know, those first steps of forming a union, and that I think it unfolded, I suppose, quite quickly, rapidly over, you know, between 90 and 94. It was quite a quick series of events that happened, but I don't think Sue at 1990, when we were wearing those grotty Liberton shirts, could have imagined what might have unfolded within 4 years.
And in those 4 years, it, not so much, I don't want to focus too much on the negativity that you probably received, but there was just a complete lack of knowledge. People didn't know. How on earth did you raise the profile? How did you spread the word to get from those 8 or 9 that were there that first session?
I mean, it was literally that advert, because there's no mobile phones. Then it was word of mouth, you know. So someone like Lee Coburn's a good example. You know, she's quite a vocal Edinburgher. She had, you know, she was larger than life, working as a manager at the Commonwealth Pool. You know, imagine her going back saying, I've started doing this women's rugby. And then she was looking, and she probably, you know, asked a few friends, you'd be good at rugby. And you know, so she, the people that joined that first advert were probably, you know, looking, and we were aware that we needed other people. So one led to another, word of mouth. And I have to say, you know, looking at the early photos, the people that played and, you know, that came for those first few sessions, you know, they played for 10 years, because we had this incredible, like, camaraderie that I've tried to explain it when we've been researching this play, but it is actually, like, I think the closest thing would be being part of an army.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not a military person. You probably know this yourself. You've just done Doddy Weir, you know, that thing that, you know, like going to Rome, you know, you get this bond when you do something collectively that's for the greater good, that brings a sort of, you know, band of brothers, band of sisters vibe. So I think very early on, looking back, we were a band of sisters that had, you know, because the odds were not in our favour. Things were being done for the first time. We were getting, you know, comments maybe about kind of, there's something weird that we're doing what we're doing. You know, you get shouted at, you know, like, you know, I mean, there was a lot of, you know, we were quite easy targets to be ridiculed. So that brings with it a huge connection, like, you're part of, like, don't diss us. And so it brought with it, you know, the group of women were very, like, protective of each other really early on, I think, because we were like suddenly absolutely bonded that you know, don't make any comment to any of our team, because we absolutely are part of the same, you know, our DNA is now completely and utterly committed to being together and doing this now. So I do think that was part of the, probably the era that we were in, because when you do anything for the first time, you are a little bit isolated perhaps, but it brings with that, it brings a huge connection with the people that you're with.
It's a bit like, you hear it often about being in the trenches, and that was, you know, let's not belittle being in the trenches, yeah, but you know what I mean? Yeah. You were fighting for something, you had a similar goal, you probably had to help each other out, you would each have had dark moments where you had to lift each other, and then moments where you disagreed, but you took someone's vision, probably Sue's. So you then start getting closer towards this union. It baffles me. How do you go about forming a union? Because you needed that to be an international, didn't you?
Well, yeah. I mean, the sort of timeline on it really is that, you know, Sue started that club. Obviously, the women's club, we had no one to play against. So she knocked on the door of the universities, who were, by this point, you know, they had a league of university clubs playing each other, and they would also play north of England. And so Sue basically knocked on the door and wouldn't take no for an answer, and said, "We're going to have to join your league." And Kim Littlejohn actually was universities at that time. And, you know, Kim and Sue's first relationship, you know, was possibly a little bit tense, because, you know, I think Kim was like, "No, we don't." It was just an awkward thing that was happening. But anyway, they, you know, I think Sue just wouldn't take no for an answer. And anyway, it was like suddenly, yeah, our club was allowed to join the league. Otherwise, you know, as Sue explained, who are you going to play when you graduate? You know, so anyway, that was resolved, and then everything was great. We were able to join that and play in the university union, and the university were already playing in the North of England division, so there was already this kind of crossover to the border. And at that time in England, they had formed like a rugby union, so actually Scotland First just joined the sort of British union, which was the kind of English rugby union. Yeah. It was sort of to cover the whole of the UK. So Sue joined that union. I'm not going to call it the English Rugby Union, because I don't want to be wrong, because it was covering Wales and Scotland. But I think it felt very much like the English Union when Sue would go to the committee meetings. And so I think after a couple of years of that, I think Sue made that, well, the start of that move and shift away to say, why are we traveling down to England to discuss, you know, things that are probably easier to sort of sort in Scotland? So she then formed the Scottish Rugby Union and broke away, I think much to their kind of surprise and a little bit distaste, but broke away and formed the Scottish Rugby Union and Scottish Women's Rugby Union. And I think there was a little sort of, ooh, at the committee meeting, and didn't expect that. So that, again, was Sue doing what she does best, which just like, I'm not going down to England to tell them what I'm doing. I'll just start my own union. And that was literally how the Scottish Women's Rugby Union was formed. And Sue, of course, being the instigator to that. And that, of course, meant that it paved the way for what was to come. I mean, we didn't know at that time what was to come, but around, I think it was 91 that happened. It's around a very, you know, similar time. Might have been, yeah. And she made the decision at that point that it was a definite mutual agreement with the Scottish Rugby Union. She approached to become and became associate. Now, God, it's either associate or affiliate. I'm the terrible. Hold on, I've literally got. I can. I'm going to fact check this for you. It's associate. To get this wrong would be horrific. That's how scared I am of Sue.
Yeah, you don't want to mess with somebody that marches all the way down to England by herself to.
Yeah, so I've actually got the timeline on the program. So, here we go. An unofficial, the Scottish Rugby Union is formed in 1992 by Sue Brodie. Okay. And she then got in touch with Scottish Rugby and asked or suggested by mutual agreement that they become associate members. And that allowed what was to follow in 94, the fact that we weren't a merged union. It meant that the Scottish Women's Rugby Union could do exactly what it pleased at that very critical point in sort of women's rugby history, when the sanctions were stopping Netherlands hosting the 94 World Cup, and they literally had to pull out because they were full joint members with the men. And because of that decision by Sue, without realizing at the time, by not becoming completely encapsulated with the SRU, it meant that there was nothing in that bar in Leith, there was nothing to stop her saying, we'll just host it, we can host it. And actually, looking back, the SRU, the relationship with the SRU was always good, because it was always clear as to what the boundaries were, and what there was no feeling of us being stopped doing what we wanted. And when Sue asked for help in 94, when we had 90 days to organize this event, the first person she called was Gregor Nicholson from the SRU, saying, we need a hand. And he said, no problem, what can I do? And within that capacity, the remit they had, obviously they couldn't put money in, because that was absolutely, there was no funding. All the funding was not for the women, but they were able to offer, they phoned Jim Fleming and he arranged all the refereeing. They just said, we'll sort the refereeing. And I think they also put a call out to all the Scottish clubs saying, please help these women, please facilitate them. And so that's when Kelso, and a lot of the clubs that host West of Scotland, the reason why they were so welcoming was because the SRU had absolutely endorsed, and encouraged them to help the women's game out at that point. And, a lot of people, possibly and probably including myself, having not really known until we've researched the play, have maybe been a bit, thinking there was some sort of, there was not a good feeling there. But looking back, Sue said, no, it was actually, they were incredibly supportive. In the reality was that, of course, was no money, because the money was all allocated to the men's game at that point, because it was the Scottish Rugby Union. So it wasn't like there was money for the women that wasn't going that way. That's why we had to buy our own shirts. All of that was, very difficult for everybody, but there was not a feeling of the Scottish Rugby Union had, there was no lack of support from them, in the same way here we are now, I think just working, now they're affiliated. For us, we were side by side, we were side by side with the love of rugby and trying to make things happen.
I love it. I didn't know that. That is a good thing to say, because I think a lot of people would have felt there was probably opposition there. So yeah. Before you get to that meeting in Leith, you've played an international and you got to be captain. How did that come around? What made you captain material? How do you bestow that honour on someone for such a momentous occasion?
So how that happened, I guess, just rewinding a fraction before, we were now playing club rugby. We've moved to Edinburgh Accies. That squad, I would say that were the Accies team, a good half a dozen, if not 8 players, were part of the Scotland team. So when the trials were held, and of course, by that point, the whole of the UK had been invited to the trials, because we'd involved a coach in London called Mark Francis, and he rounded up the exiles. And then there was the Scotland trials, the full Scottish trials that became the first international, the one you're referring to, in Edinburgh, Ireland, Scotland, 93. At that point, I had, I suppose, it's ridiculous, been playing for 3 years. But looking back, every single player was getting their first cap, and there was a lot of inexperience in the team. So I suppose what we'd had is at least, 3 years worth of playing together with a lot of the same squad that were in Accies, that were winning things. Of course, we beat all the university students, I might add. Like, we were a very strong side, because every time a good player graduated, they joined Edinburgh Accies. Kim Littlejohn became, from Edinburgh University, part of Accies. And every time, a player left the university, they would join us. And Donna Kennedy, I think she played at one point for, there was a, this team just kept building momentum and strength. So I was fortunate. I was the captain of that team for a number of years. And I think just having that connection with that club and that club playing, you know, a really heavy part of the first international was why I was very lucky and honoured to be selected as captain. And I think it was partly because I'd been captaining the club for quite some time. And the position of scrum half, you are sort of in the middle to hear what everyone's going on, talk to the forwards and the backs. Actually, I remember so clearly my father saying to me that day, like, he just gave me this massive hug. He was so proud because he is a rugby man. And he said, no matter what happens, if you never play again, you'll be on every single bit of paper, you know, because you're now a history. You're in the history books because it's the first. And I remember not really understanding what that meant until, you know, later on. And he, you know, he literally had tears in his eyes. He was such a proud, it was quite a proud moment on a personal level. And then actually straight at, very, very soon after that, I literally had one captaincy cap. And very soon after, Roddy and Mark both decided that Kim Littlejohn was actually a better fit, playing at centre, further back, also incredibly, you know, really good at reading the game, probably better than I was, to be fair. I was often getting my head down, getting too involved with the details of trying to get the ball out. And I think Kim reading the game, also great at talking to players, and everyone respected Kim. So shortly after that, you know, she became the captain and then remained the captain, you know, for her, I think, I might be wrong, but I think for maybe the whole time she played, certainly for the vast majority, she was captain and she made a phenomenal captain. We were, you know, all really lucky to have her at an absolute peak because she's a real someone that has, she just has so much respect by everybody because you wanted her on your side because she's so hard as nails. I mean, the way she tackled, you couldn't have a better captain in terms of, you know, someone who is sort of leading by example. And so, you know, I feel incredibly honoured to have had that, you know, the privilege of leading. But I was very comfortable with the change to Kim shortly after. In fact, I sort of honestly remember feeling a bit relieved because, you know, when you're trying to play a game, it's a hell of a lot to do, never mind worrying about all the PR and marketing, which we do touch on the play, because Kim was really thrown in the deep end and had to sort of do media appearances. We were all so young looking back, you know, and she just had to get on with it all.
You don't mess with Kim. No. So Sue's going down to England now. I think we have to try and get some context here because at the moment we're probably thinking, oh, how hard can that be? There's no Zoom, there's no internet. She's traveling to these meetings, she's then coming back, she's telling everybody what's going on, I would imagine largely by word of mouth again. And then this momentum's beginning to build, you're in the league, but a lot of this, I'm guessing, is coming out of your own pocket. People are paying for these things themselves. There must have been a loss of people through the demand of it on top of life. Things weren't easy. Money was, you know, you were having to outlay your own cash. So how did you keep hold of people? Was it just that camaraderie? Was that what glued people together?
I mean, I think the camaraderie, we all wanted to play. When you got on the pitch and played, it was worth every hassle that came with it. You know, the hassle involving, you know, you just touched on, you know, the communication. I do remember, as I'm a graphic designer, and I remember I always got roped into doing these. We used to do an annual handbook which had everybody's phone number in it, you know, like, I mean, I'm talking for the Scottish Rugby Union. It was a little A5 booklet, and it would have every club and it would have every phone number of, like, you know, three three names to contact, you know, the secretary, the captain, because this was the only way to be able to phone up, because you had to phone up before the game. Is the game still on? Is it cancelled? Is it, you know, and so the only way to communicate was through this little A5 handbook. So once a year, we would duly put together this, it was horrific, you know, put together this bloody piece of, and then, you know, you're trying to, and then some bloody person had changed, hadn't they? And then they've left, and then someone, that phone number was, they've moved house. And you were constantly trying to keep this little handbook up to date so that when the league matches were announced.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You know, if there was a, you know, because, you know, can you imagine? Then there's a, the weather's bad, a flood, the pitch is cancelled, and then everyone's having to phone and like rearrange a fixture and all this stuff. I mean, looking back, it was horrific. And the only people that were doing that was in every club and up and down the country. Every club had to have these poor people, like, you know, on the committee that were bothering to bloody do all the details, which was to update and phone in the result, you know, because you need, someone plays a game, you need to know what the score was, so then you need to phone out what was the score. Oh, so that person's forgot to phone in, right? Need to honestly, it was heinous looking back. Luckily, I actually have forgotten all that until you've said, but each club in Scotland, of course, not just Ackies, you know, we were all having to do that with each other, and that was for the love. Look at it. That was the love of the game. It was so that you could play the game you loved. And every club in Scotland had a group of women who had found something they enjoyed doing and would make it happen. And it got easier and easier because it was so horrendous to begin with. As technology improved things, you know, of course, it became a little bit easier as well because, you know, emails, suddenly things did make a huge difference. That was a huge thing to be able to email, you know, information around the place.
So you're preparing for a World Cup. Mm. You're expecting to travel to a World Cup. Mm. How was the planning for that? Because, you know, before we get to the World Cup's off, what sort of preparation had you been going through up to that point? And then how did you find out that they've pulled the plug?
So after the Scotland-Ireland game, I mean, there was a series of friendly internationals. Well, I don't think it was quite a five nations, but, you know, our coaches would, you know, put dates in the diary for playing Wales or Ireland, you know, and England, because we all knew that the Holland 98, you know, 94 World Championship, World Cup was, you know, actually quite an 18 months away. So there was a plan in place to build the momentum from us having now a national team that we would then want to play maybe three or four times before going to that World Cup. So literally from that Ireland game, there was, you know, Roddy and Mark, the coaches, they would pull together a schedule of, like, you know, we're going to play Wales, then we're going to play England. They had like this schedule of games prepped before the tournament. So we all went away. We had a summer training program. We would have maybe like different dates in the diary where everyone would come together, not dissimilar to now, you know, where everyone's playing for their clubs all over the country. And then every so often there was these arranged dates where we would all meet up and train as a squad, and then there would be potentially an international friendly. So that was all completely diarised, and it was very much, I mean, it was a properly, you know, we were by that point, we were up and running. We'd had a national team. We were good to go. We had phenomenal coaching that were, you know, free of charge, giving their time for the love of it. We started to get a kit sponsor. You know, we were beginning to feel really like going places. So that was the build up really until January 1994. So that was, of course, the fateful fax coming to Sue in her office in Edinburgh.
I would love to have, well, I wouldn't because it would be horrible, but I can't imagine how she felt reading that. She must have had to read it again and again, and then the emotion that must have swept over her holding a bit of paper. And you know, there's potentially people watching or listening to this who won't have a clue what a fax is, never mind anything else. But she got that. What was the immediate chain of events from her receiving that?
Well, we've talked about that just very recently, and you know, she remembers getting that fax. She was in her office, and she said she can't quite remember how long it took her, but you know, I think she phoned me and a half, like three or four other people that, you know, she just had to tell. And she thinks she can't remember if it was like the same day or a couple of days. It was probably, it might have been the same day, but I think she'd said, like, let's say it was Tuesday, let's meet on Wednesday. Like a day later, it was like, let's meet in Leith in a bar because we need to discuss what we're going to do. And I'm not fully sure the exact how many hours passed, but, you know, it would have been within a day or two or three at the most, because I think as she read it, you know, the first reaction would have been, you know, this is like us all, devastation. But I think very quickly her, you know, the things were churning in her head very quickly, because by the time we met in that bar in Leith, she had that plan formulated in her head. You know, she told us what she intended to do or what she thought she wanted to discuss hosting the event. So we, you know, it wasn't a debate. She called us there because she had kind of figured out what she was going to say, which was, I've been thinking about this and I think we should host. I think we should say we can do it. And literally, do you know what?
There's that stereotype of, and you see it sometimes, it comes up, someone will have, no good story ever starts with, I was having a salad, you know. So many rugby stories start with, we were in a bar, or we were in the clubhouse, or we were having a beer, but not many of them finish with, and then we made a World Cup.
I mean, looking back, that she came with that idea, and because we were in a pub, I think we need another drink, don't we, to sort of think this through. And I think the more beers we had, the more absolutely sure we were it was a brilliant idea. And that's my sort of fond memory of it, is that I remember I went to that bar. I did not know that was what she was going to say. But by the time we got out of that bar, we were so bloody excited that we were going to still play rugby at the World Cup. It was just this awkward, annoying thing that we were having to organize it, but that is all going to be fine.
There must have been so many waking up the next morning, kind of rubbing your eyes, going, are we going to organize a World Cup?
Honestly, I don't think, I mean, looking back, seriously, joking apart, we were not drunk. We were actually like, we were literally going, oh my God, because, you know, when I look back at who she called, it was quite a strategic call to arms. Because the people that were, there was maybe sort of six of us that were called. And looking back, we all could do something useful to make it happen. You know, Roddy, I'm sure, was there, the coach. And then myself, my then partner at the time, worked in a bank, like, you're treasurer. Sandra, you're a designer. That's all the programs. Janine, you're a nurse. Right, that we need to sort out ambulances. We need Maureen. we're going to need volunteers. We're going to need to grab. Basically, she had already sort of, the cogs had been working, and she was pretty much, you know, starting to explain her strategy of what, how this was going to happen, because there was, and so then I think literally the next day, having all agreed that we were up for it, she then faxed all the countries. And there's a, this famous fax, because a couple of people have framed it, you know, which says, the tournament in the Netherlands has been cancelled, but Scotland are going to host it. Please accept, or, you know, please let us know if you're going to coming, you know, as soon as possible. And that was the fax that I think England have got it in their history, you know, as because it's that fax changed the history of the Women's World Cups, because you know the call went out across the nations, and you know 12 countries responded with a yes, which was incredible and like terrifying, and everything all rolled into one, because then it was like holy shit.
It's so mad though, because it
mad, yeah.
Now, I'm not belittling this at all. It was on your doorstep. But for other countries to go, yeah, let's go to something that's been thrown together in 90 days and hope that it works. That you said it before, that kind of sisterhood, people you'd never met were part of that and have gone, yeah, we're going for it, because like you said, we just want to play. We're going to do what we can because we want to play. And, you know, this play that you've written and you're about to put on, of course it's for you and it's for the characters who'll be portrayed and it's for the people who are sitting in the audience, but it goes much further than that.
It does, because, you know, I mean, the gamble, which ended up being a good one, was, you know, these countries must be as devastated as we are. They must feel the same. Let's see, you know, because actually Holland is really near Edinburgh. Like, it's a connecting flight. It's 1 hour. If you're coming from Canada or you're coming from the US or you're coming from, you know, you can get a connection, you know, from Schiphol to Edinburgh quite easily. So that was the calculation, that they will be as gutted as us. They will have flights to Schiphol, to Amsterdam. What we're asking them to do is get one onward flight and to change their accommodation. We're not changing the dates. So I think, and being, you know, Sue's decision to, you know, you could not delay the sending that fax. It had to be quick. I mean, looking back, what would we have done if it had had six replies? It might have been really tough, but the fact that there wasn't 12 teams in the end, but initially there was 12 that said yes, including us. And we could kind of bank on England, Ireland and Wales, you know, and we thought France, you know, we were fairly comfortable that they would come. So then you think, well, that's us got four or five. It's going to be a measure of what will happen with the overseas countries that, like Japan, you know, Russia, Kazakhstan, whether they would pull out. And, you know, that was the thing that we were not sure of. And of course, as history has shown, you know, they just went no problem. Yep, that's fine. We're coming still.
No problem. So you fast forward now, you know, a lot has happened in the women's game. And I know a lot of the current crop of players who are phenomenal athletes and role models, and a lot of them had no clue to any of this, no clue to the story. They didn't know the names. They grew up watching Scottish male internationals and you know, probably pretending to be them or watching them, and they didn't know. There's been a big bit of connecting the past and the present and bringing the people in the middle into it as well, and now it's another. The sisterhood's just grown, hasn't it?
And there's something wonderful happening. I've got such a good feeling about this current squad, because I see in them what we had a you know, I was very lucky to be around that kind of, when a team, a sort of, you get, I always describe things like, they're a bit like, you know, waves. So you get peaks and troughs. And when a momentum goes up like this, you can feel it in your bones. And like, I was lucky, you know, between 93 and 98, you know, that there was a real period of Scotland just on the rise. And I think I see it again at this with this current group, because they, I see a real parallel in history, because when we were in 93, I would say England were about 5 or 6 years ahead of us, because they had just been doing it for longer. You know, we were on our first caps at the World Cup. Maybe we, I think in the programme, everyone's got three claps. And the England team, they've all got 12, 15 caps. You know, they had just had these extra years in them that you need. You can't just be the same as someone if you've got a cap and versus someone who's got 15 caps. And when I look at the current squad and I see, you know, the parallel with how long the England team have professional players and how, you know, they're probably 5, 6 years in it, you know, where England, Scotland are now parallel doing the same, having the same level of support and development now with professional full-time players. And you feel it that because what is great to know what's coming is that England don't get any better. And all that happens is Scotland can come up and they can really, because, you know, because they'll then start to have people retiring and things go in waves. And what you've got, if you've got a group of players who are at the same time, you know, sort of developing at the same, you know, and seeing the improvements, if you, you know, any time a squad of players can come through and they can just do things that maybe 10 years ago you couldn't have imagined, because it's timing, you know. And I do think that this squad right now, having, you know, I've met a few of them in the last year, and I've just seen a change. I see a change in attitude. You know, I think the most recent game against France, they were absolutely gutted. Mm-hmm. As yep. in, they thought that was one that got by. They were gutted about not beating a team that's third ranked in the world. I mean, come on. Look, you know, that's the difference. You know, if you'd asked them that question 3 years ago, they'd be thrilled at how it was quite close. So they're in a different place and there's way more to come, in my view. And I do see a lot that we can, well, I think just this whole anniversary thing has allowed perhaps a lot of conversations, you know, with, yep. with old and younger players coming through, which is, it's got to be healthy, because I feel that the English Roses are maybe 5 years ahead as well at how well the old girls have supported the young yep. girls. You know, at the World Cup, they were all there and they have this, you know, Jill Burns, led by Jill Burns, you know, they're incredibly, you know, like, They've done all that, and I think it's, you know, looking at it, I think the Scotland Thistles, led by Kim and Beth McLeod, and you know, this is really important, because it's, how dare Jill Burns and her crew have won over our Scottish girls? We've got better old girls than they. We've got their back more.
We've got a play. That is some fighting talk. The first time we met, yeah. Rona Lloyd and Lisa Thompson were there, and I feel I've been privileged to be part of quite a lot of moments that are big to me, maybe not big in the grand scheme of things, but there was a definite awakening in them when they met you, of what had gone before. And I know I've spoken to Emma Wassell about this, and various others. I know Brian Eason takes it very seriously about telling the story and them knowing where, what's happened before them, not where they've come from, but what's happened before them. And I love seeing the energy that it brings and the spark that it brings, not just to the current players, but to you guys as well. And now you've got this play and it's come around in an amazing way, which we will talk about. But the first question I want to ask you is, how on earth did you go about choosing the actors for it? How did that happen?
Well, that process, actually, we have done so well with our crowdfunding and sponsorship that has allowed us to hire a professional director. And so Sue and I sat in on the casting, but quite frankly, it was not to do with us, because I was looking for kind of Demi Moore kind of vibes.
You know, that was what I was going to say. Who was the most vain about the whole thing?
Kind of thinking G.I. Jane, you know, like Demi Moore. I had that in my head. And, you know, but quite frankly, it was nothing to do with us. And there was the one thing that I will, not a spoiler, but they nearly all have long hair. We made a decision early on that they couldn't really look like us, quite frankly. For most people look a lot more attractive than us, and they all have long hair. And so there was no way we could really replicate our kind of our look in the 1994 sort of short hair kind of like look that we've got. The director felt that, you know, it was far better to cast, you know, the most talented and good young people that are there in Scotland today. So the looky likey thing went out the window, which let's say we've had an upgrade, like without a doubt. Sue has bloody done brilliant. Sue's now blonde. I have to say, always wanted to be blonde. I've got long hair, which is quite nice to see. So we've all slightly, we're very much representing, my character is very much representing that girl that was never allowed to play. And you know, the one that really is the same as Sue, you know, because her character is, without Sue, there would have been no World Cup. So really that one lies through. And there is quite a bit of artistic license on my character and Kim and Annie, one of the first players as well, where we're trying to sort of give a little snapshot of the type of why rugby meant so much to different types of women. So there has to be within that storyline, you know, we've had to allow Kim Miller, the writer, to, you know, really make it a really good hour's show where the characters have got to have a little bit of contrast. So I would say the facts are absolutely accurate. Some of it perhaps is a little bit of artistic license, thrown in as well.
So let's give the story then. So the World Cup was thrown together in 90 days. I shouldn't say that. It was planned in 90 days.
Thrown together, actually, so is more accurate.
Where, how, what, all those questions, you, a play, why a play, why not a book, why, like, how did this thing come around?
Very quickly, I first thought, I bought books and I did a course on, I started a course doing screenwriting, thinking I want to write it I saw it as a film. After doing a few months of this sort of evening classes, lockdown happened, I also had enough knowledge that this wasn't going to happen in my lifetime, you know, because I run a full-time business and I just thought it's way too big a task. I'd done enough. I'd learned enough to know that was never going to happen. So I then, after lockdown, I went on a solo cycle up to the Hebrides and I just kind of had a week on my own, trying to tossing around and feeling, how could I make this happen? And I literally came back and thought, oh my God, what about a play? Because 1 hour, we could do that. We're in Edinburgh. It could be, you know, it's something that we could do. I don't know how. And honestly, thinking amateur dramatics at this point, like maybe we'll be in it. Don't know. Like, you know, we phoned up Edinburgh. I phoned up Sue. She thought it was a great idea and said very sensibly, let's try and raise some money crowdfunding. And if there's nobody wanting to donate, then it's a terrible idea. And if people donate, then we kind of know we're onto something. So we raised £10,000 in 80 days, which told us we were onto something. And then around that time was when people kept saying, you need to talk to Ed, you need to talk to Ed Crozier. And his name kept popping up in conversations. So I gave him a call. And then that, of course, led to, you know, because we've now got a bit of money here. He was like, that's absolutely nowhere near enough to put on a show. Because if you're going to do it, you might as well do it properly. And he had, I think that kind of knowledge and encouragement, you know, would you have known how much it would cost to put on a show? Probably not. So I'll tell you, a lot. And I have to just name check, if you don't mind, that, you know, without the support of the Bill McLaren Foundation, who came in as a really early sponsor, and so did Levy and McRae lawyers in Glasgow. They were the two that came in straight within that critical period, you know, around sort of September, October, where we knew that we needed to raise quite a lot more money. They came in when we really didn't have much to go on apart from us sort of saying what we were trying to do. And then laterally, we've also had two phenomenal sponsors. One is by the Scottish Brain Science, which is part of the SRU, you know, thing to do. Partly because they're brain testing us because we're over 50 head injuries. And every time they do a brain test, we talk about the play. So I think we've worn them down. They've come in as a sponsor. And then finally, Culverwell, which is one of our original shirt sponsors in the 90s. Wow. Now, the poor guy, he had no choice because he was getting phoned every single day by Sarah Float from Edinburgh Accies. And she just would not let him go until he eventually said, "You're the most persistent person that's ever phoned. Like, what will it take to make you go away?" So we've got a shirt sponsor is now the kit sponsor of the costume. So, you know, by hook or by crook, we got there. And none of this would have happened without the Edinburgh Accies Old Girls, which is not just Scotland players by any means. It's the Vicky Mendelsons. It's the guys, Fee Glasgow, people that were our club mates who we just, you know, Sue and I phoned them up, started a WhatsApp group and said, "Would you help us organise this? Because we do not have the right skill set and you guys have marketing experience, sponsorship experience. Basically, you can help us get some money in and also help us run the place." And we also got an old girl, Trine, I call her one woman Rami, but she is the treasurer. She's looking after all the money. So, you know, between us, it's like the old Accies gang is back doing what it does best, annoying people, raising money, not taking no for an answer. And here we are, a week to go. We've got the money in the bank. We've been able to hire the professionals. So, you know, it's proper stuff now. And it's now, you know, out of Edinburgh Accies, out of us acting, to professionals at the Traverse Theatre. So who would have thought that could have happened? But who would have thought a World Cup could have happened as well? So.
I know. I reckon you guys could change the world. Let's get you all into Parliament and see if you can shake up the whole country. So there's the famous, or one of the famous speeches from the 97 Lions, where Ian McGeoghan says, "In 30 years' time, you'll be walking down the street and there'll just be a look." And that's what this sounds like. You put out the rallying call, and I think everybody would have just said yes without a moment's hesitation. Yeah. Because you're right, it's not just the Scotland players. You're telling everyone's story. Mm-hmm. Here. This is a big deal.
Yeah.
You're on next week. The reason I commented about 7 o'clock us having this conversation, yeah, is because that's 1 week away from curtain up and, mm-hmm, you know, proper show time. Mm-hmm. You've been busy. You know, you run your own business, you're doing this, which is probably a full-time job on top of that. Mm-hmm. What, when you sit in that seat next Friday, surrounded by some of your oldest friends, people that you've been through all this with, curtain goes up, have you any clue what that's going to feel like?
I'm sort of visualizing, like, in my head. I'm not visualizing anything other than it just being a phenomenally good show and a great night, and one that you remember for the rest of your life, you know, like the World Cup. That's what I'm visualizing, because I think that the stars are aligning. I feel that. I just feel it in my bones. I just feel we've got people flying over from New Zealand. The World Cup, England World Cup winning captain is flying over from New Zealand. Karen Almond and Jill Burns, they're all coming up. They're using this as a chance for them to remember winning the World Cup. So other people are using it for their own, you know, for their own kind of opportunity to embrace, you know, some of these amazing things that happened. We've got Annie, who's one of the ones that we're representing in our as an actor. She's flying in from New Zealand. When I see who's coming, the World Rugby, someone's coming from there. You know, there's people coming from all over the place just to, I think we've managed to capture something where people are really intrigued and they want to see what it's all about. And the resounding thing that I keep hearing is that most people don't know the story and they're genuinely wanting in a week's time to like sort of see what happened because they don't know it. And that is exactly, that was the mission, was to share the story, as simple as that. And I think I've got a feeling something more is going to happen because I think that it's hopefully going to make a connection with this current squad, that this is way beyond, you know, this privilege that you have to wear that shirt, what it means and how you'll have it for the rest of your life. And, you know, if we do a small amount towards motivating them to feel that they know that the whole of Scotland has their back, then we've done something really powerful. And, you know, we'll also have an absolute blast seeing everyone that we used to hang around with. So, you know, but actually it's about the future. You know, it's about, you know, before we're too old and we can't remember it and we can't actually, you know, at the moment I'm gathering together all the photos for the programme and they're still, you know, we're still young enough to be able to sort of get them downloaded off and put them and archive them. I'm actually was speaking to Scottish Rugby this afternoon because we've done a milestone, you know, like all the dates from 90 to 2025. And it actually, I found a piece of nugget today that it was actually 1962 when the first Scottish university side, Edinburgh University, actually was before us in 90. So who knew? So we've got a chance to pull together the whole of the history of the Scottish women's game and use it in a way that perhaps will be the archive for the future, you know, and maybe some of this will end up being in the Scottish rugby as a bit of, you know, we're capturing our history whilst we remember it.
It's just absolutely incredible. I feel a little bit emotional. I think you've had little moments as we've gone along and spoken. I thought you summed it up beautifully there in so many ways. You summed up the game of rugby there of people coming together, just wanting to enjoy it, but inspiring the future, how important it is to enjoy the moment. If you can look into that crystal ball, there's no way you could have predicted where the game is now when you rocked up to that session at Liberton or played in your first international or played in the first World Cup. I don't think you could have imagined what had happened. Or maybe you could, and maybe you wanted it to happen quicker. But when you look into your crystal ball in 10 years' time, when it's the 40th anniversary, what can you see?
Honestly, I could see Scotland winning a Grand Slam in the next 10 years. I could see them being in the top 4-5 in the world. I could see them, like we feel about the Scotland men, you know, there's a feeling like, yeah, they could beat anyone on a good day. I see that in the future, and that's within the next 10 years, I see a feeling that the Scottish women will be on an equal platform with the rest of the world countries, because the infrastructure that's happening now, you know, the players will change. That's the whole point, you know, 10 years time, some of these girls will be retiring. But, you know, if we're building something strong coming through, that's the wonderful thing about rugby, isn't it? You know, that a team like, look at England, you know, they're invincible and then suddenly they get beaten. So, you know, I see Scotland being in 10 years' time within the 10 years to come, being absolute contenders to win the World Cup. Why not? Absolutely, I see that.
Did you get swept away with the Lionesses? That was probably the pinnacle of women's sport. It was almost the perfect storm. It was a beautiful summer. It was in this country. Did you enjoy that? Did you look at that and think, I'd like a piece of that for us, please?
Yeah. I mean, in some ways I look back and wish I'd gone, because I think it was really exceptional for the people that flew out there. I mean, I watched it, you know, got up in the middle of the night and watched it. And the final, I mean, honestly, it was emotional. It was just, you know, honestly sort of teary to see these packed stadiums. And actually, I genuinely did feel sorry for, you know, it was such a, it was one of those games. It was an absolute thriller, you know, just what you want for a World Cup final. And actually, I just, anyone that's played back in these olden days, you know, in the early days, it is emotional. It's emotional to see this incredible energy and see how far things have come. And it's not about wanting to be there, because it isn't. You know, I think the men with, when, you know, the ones that were pre-professional, you know, you can't undo your own history. It is just what it is, and you love it for what it was. But I do look now, and it's just actually wonderful to see. That's actually the overriding feeling. I just get such a thrill at seeing all these women, you know, and even the young girls, you know, that are so keen on the sport. And you think, God, you're only 8 and you're so stoked. What are you going to be like when you're 18? Never mind 28, you know. And that is a thrill. It's a total thrill to sort of watch that unfold.
Can you see us filling out Murrayfield for a women's international?
I certainly can see us filling out the Hive next weekend. I think it is with the England game. I think that's very close to capacity. I think you've got to watch, because there's something beautiful about a tight crowd.
Yeah.
And you know, also let's not get ahead of ourselves. You know, there's a beautiful atmosphere.
Yeah.
With these games that I think you want to protect that, you know, in terms of feeling intense. There's something, I think that there'll come a point, yes, where if there's more and more people, it will get bigger. But I think there is probably a challenge at the moment from going from the Hive to anything bigger without it feeling like somehow
you lose the atmosphere.
So also, I think if the women are paying their way, you know, the tickets are not free, everything's sold out, and it's at the right price at the Hive. It's got lots of, or Hive Stadium, I think, not the Hive. I don't know. I think it's about the woman paying their way. I would have thought that would be their first mission. And it has to, when I saw the game last weekend, you know, there is a hugely mixed crowd of young people, mm-hmm. and just guys that are watching it. And it feels like there could definitely be, especially if the women are successful, because everyone loves to watch a team that might win. So I think it does go hand in hand. It's been proven, hasn't it? When the men play well, you know, the tickets are harder to get than if they're going through a bit of a doldrum. So it's all connected. And I do think these women are absolutely in a sort of the start of it, or they're still on an upward trajectory at this point.
Yeah, I hate this phrase, but it's a good product. It's worth watching.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And I think it's, like you say, I think it's going to continue to, when you see some of the young players coming through, and we're still missing one or two. So there's still absolutely a chance for it to get better. Sandra, I've absolutely loved it. I could talk for a very long time. This bit I didn't tell you. So I need you to finish the sentence. So for me, happiness is egg-shaped. But for Sandra, happiness is...
Happiness is a premier sellout show next with nobody breaking a leg next Friday.
I think we'll all take that. Thank you so much. I look forward to seeing you in the flesh soon. Congratulations on everything up to this point. It's just, I think your story is amazing. I think there's more to tell. You're going to have to come back on for part two.
Final plug. You can live stream the show if you go to our website, because it is a sellout, and you can make a donation and you can actually see see the show. We're doing a live stream on the Saturday after the women take on England. So if anybody did want to, if they've missed out on tickets, if they just Google 90 days play, they'll find out how to make a donation and watch the show live.
Awesome. We'll put that on all the blurb that goes with this stuff so that people can do it. That is amazing. Sandra, all the best. I've got no doubt it's going to be amazing. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
See you soon.
Thank you.
How good. That was long, and it could have been a lot longer. So there's definitely going to have to be a part two. We're going to have to find out how it went. Please make sure you tune in. If you've not got tickets, then the live stream, you're going to have to see it, because people are going to be talking about it. She's put in a load of work, just like they did to make the World Cup happen. So the play 90 days. Can you believe it? What an amazing feat. I hope you've enjoyed it. If you did, you can get it on Apple, Acast and Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can watch on Facebook and YouTube, and there will be loads of this to come. You're going to be reading about it for a long time, and hopefully it's going to go on the road and we'll be able to see it in lots of other places. In the meantime, my name is Bruce Aitchison from the Happiness Is podcast, and my happiness is egg-shaped. I'll see you all again very, very soon. Come on, Scotland!
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.